Well, it's a pleasure to be here and give this mini course on integrability in ABS-CFT. My part will be concerned with classical strings and spin chains, and tomorrow Matthias will take over and talk about the beta ansatz, anything related to the beta ansatz. So I'll leave this completely out of my talk. This is work which was done in the last 2.5 years. What I will be reporting about is mostly concerned with these papers. Okay, so brief introduction. I don't really have to introduce the ABS-CFT correspondence to you. It states what I will be concerned with. It states that n equals 4 gauge theory should be exactly dual to 2B superstrings on ADS5 process 5, and I'm focusing on one aspect which. Which says that the spectra of both theories should agree, and I'd like to just test that as far as possible. However, the generic problem in performing these tests is that it's a strong weak duality, so we cannot use perturbation theory on both sides of the duality simultaneously, so it's hard to actually do comparisons. There are some hopes of getting around that, and maybe there's even a stronger hope that both models could maybe be solved even for intermediate values of the coupling exactly, at least in the planar limit, and that's related to integrability. So the outline of my talk will be, first of all, I'll try to explain how we try to compare the spectras, even though it's a strong weak duality, and what are the problems of that. Then the most part of the talk will be concerned with classical superstrings, the classical superstring signal model, and its integrability. And I'll try to motivate or show you how to obtain for each classical solution of this string theory or the signal model. For each solution, you get one algebraic curve. And this allows you to look at the conserved quantities or the physical quantities of the classical solution in a convenient way. And then afterwards, I'll introduce gauge theory and spin chains, how spin chains arise from gauge theory, what are the states, what is the Hamiltonian, and most importantly, how you get results and what integrability means here at one loop and at higher loops.
General perspective, partly related to what Joe said yesterday. So I'm trying to understand in what sense you have integrability on both sides. For example, on the string side, it's for the world sheet theory.
Yes.
And then on the gauge theory side, it's for the gauge theory, which is like the space-time theory reduced to the boundary.
In gauge theory, the integrability is actually related to the large N world sheet theory.
Okay.
So although you have a four-dimensional theory where you know that integrability can't really exist in an interacting or interesting theory, here it's related to taking the large N limit and getting spin chains, and spin chains can be integrable because they are a two-dimensional model. So I hope to explain how we get integrability in string theory and gauge theory, and maybe afterwards you can ask again. Yes. So this is related to my general assumptions here. In string theory, I consider only classical strings. This need not be so, but certainly we need to consider only non-interacting strings. And so no. On gauge theory side, I take into account interactions, but I consider only the large N limit, strict large N limit. I only have planar diagrams, which is the same as non-interacting strings. And in gauge theory, whenever I say gauge theory, I mean perturbative gauge theory. Whenever I say string theory, it's going to be perturbative string theory, so large lambda, small lambda. Okay, so let's consider the ADS-CFT correspondence. Again, ADS-CFT predicts that the spectra of string strings in gauge theory should match. And what you compare are string energies, where energy means translation in the ADS space along the time coordinate, and in gauge theory it means scaling dimensions. And in string theory, you can access string theory at large lambda in perturbation theory, and generically you would expect the energies to scale as fourth root of lambda for large lambda, and then there are corrections which are always down by square root of lambda from order to order. In gauge theory, the scaling dimensions of local operators, you can expand at small lambda. You have some classical piece, one loop piece, two loop piece, and so on, higher orders. And now the problem is, if you want to confirm that the spectra agree, so an energy should equal a scaling dimension, you don't really know what to do in this perturbative expansion, because you can't match the coefficients. They are completely different series. I have no idea. I think they should be. Oops,
I think your problem is well put.
I think in the large N limit they should be.
Planar perturbation theories are typically planar perturbation conversion. So we don't have a proof here, but that is a strong suspicion.
Right. So,
I think it's important, right? Because if we just have spotted energy, the question would be, does there exist a function to have a function
okay, but then how
what Matthias says is right, and I think it's important.
At least you could argue that there's no known source for non perturbative effects. Right? Because instant ones are not there. So then you'd really have a hard time to say what should be source non-perturbative effects that would lead to asymptotic perturbations.
Right, because the theory is finite. Otherwise, there would definitely be the normal half.
That's right. That would be an alternative source for...
Yeah, but the theory is component.
Right, so that's a good point.
So, my point
okay, I mean, anyway, I was just saying that you may expand using perturbative methods, but you won't compare anyway, so...
But one more comment. I mean, I suspect that on the string side, indeed, it is not
perturbative. At least
there are no arguments, like in gauge theory, to argue that it should somehow be a convergent series. And so
why is that? Why can't you apply the same argument? Cauchy theory is finite, and there is no obvious instrument. It's a form argument to apply, so why this doesn't apply to Cauchy theory?
No, but it's a real...
No, but there's a difference between planar graphs and
non-graphs. Oh, I see.
So the standard argument is that the primarity of the graphs reduces it from an infractorial number of graphs to a power.
I thought chance that all these studies in string theory and the PMM that have found some strange numbers.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh,
that's true.
Okay, so let's say everything is somehow well defined, and this series makes sense. it's just an assumption, but now we try to improve this comparison, and now we just don't consider specific states, but we consider a class of states or one parameter family of states where we introduce J as some spin on S5 as a variable, and maybe also lots of other parameters, lots of mode numbers, lots of other amplitudes. But I'll focus on this one, on spin J on S5. And there you can construct some kind of effective spin, or same thing as an effective coupling constant. This is J over square root of lambda. That's because the spin should scale. Well, just looking at the Lagrangian, this is a reasonable thing to do. And if you just invert this and square it, you get something which is very similar to the BMN coupling constant. Now, if you do this, if you expand string theory energies at large lambda, but now you keep this J fixed, which includes this lambda, I think generically you find now not a fourth root, but a second, just a square root of lambda as the leading piece. And now the energies also depend on this effective spin or coupling. So then again, there are string sigma model corrections organizing in 1 over square root of lambda powers. In gauge theory, the same, well, you don't qualitatively change anything. It's just that the coefficients now depend on J. Okay. So why do you think this gives you a better handle? Well, now you expand for large J or a small lambda tilde at large lambda, and you see the first coefficient, the coefficient of lambda, of square root of lambda, scales like this curly J, and then there are further corrections in 1 over J squared, so J to the minus 1, J to the minus 3, and so on. And the higher loop, the string sigma model corrections, they also have some expansion in J, which you believe would be also in powers of 1 over J squared, and so on. So now if you replace this J by J over square root of lambda, straight J over lambda, and you write this all out, you find this expansion here. So what's nice about this is that you only see integer powers of lambda, like these, and integer powers of 1 over J. So this is what you expect from this expansion. And that's particularly nice because now you can think, okay, we get integer powers of lambda, that's what we get in gauge theory, so maybe we can compare those coefficients. Okay, so in gauge theory, we do the same. We now expand at large J, and the classical piece is sort of trivial, but then you find the one loop piece starts out as 1 over J, the two loop piece starts out as 1 over J cubed, and the three loop as 1 over J to the fifth, and you write this in this form. And again, the structure neatly agrees with that from string theory. So you're very cheerful, and you compare one loop. Here, the coefficient turns out to be the same. This coefficient turns out to be the same. Here, you get agreement. But if you go to three loops, all of a sudden, you get a different answer for gauge theory and for strings. So this here is different from that, and the same should hold for that. Now you ask, why is that? What does that mean? Does it mean the ABS-CFT correspondence is wrong in some subtle sense? And well, the point is we can't really infer anything from this three loop gauge theory, classical strings. This is the leading, next to leading, next, next leading, next, next, next leading. So in this here, it's this coefficient. It starts out being wrong, and I think this should be wrong as well. Okay, well, so the problem really is in the way you expand. So in gauge theory, the leading piece, the first thing you expand is this. This is the one loop, in some sense, leading piece, because that's trivial. And you see that the coefficients go along this diagonal. Whereas if you look at string theory, the classical piece, which is the first thing you obtain, comes here. And as doing expansions is something like doing limits, you're just having some order of limits problem, potentially. So we can't really infer anything from that for ADS CFT, and the strong weak problem persists. Even it gets worse, because if you do this string theory expansion more carefully, you see that this is not the right expansion, but there are further terms which you might easily miss. This is just what we found out recently. So this expansion now looks like this, and here are additional pieces. So if you knew this from the beginning, there wouldn't even be a point in comparing this to gauge theory, because it doesn't match. And now these... yeah. You just do semi-classical methods. So this is one loop string sigma model, and in this order you can do a semi-classical. You just obtain things by summing over fluctuation modes. It's just the usual. Or you take your classical solution, you perturb it a bit, solve this system to quadratic order, and get the spectrum, and so on. So this is just standard quantum perturbative quantum mechanics. So. No. Just Green Schwarz. Then light cone. And
three. So. Using the Polish action changes.
Mm. Well, then one of the two is wrong. I don't know. I have no idea. Should be the same. Because this is a physical quantity, so. Anyway, so now you're a bit puzzled maybe, but something interesting happens, because actually this was the first coefficient which went wrong, where the comparison didn't work out. And now you find this coefficient here, and you might think, okay, this is done by a square root of lambda, so you might think this is a correction to this term. And maybe if you extrapolate from large lambda to small lambda, using this term and maybe further terms down here and well, this tower, you might recover the right result for gauge theory. We even have some quantitative handle on that. Anyway, so what I want to say is we try to avoid the strong weak duality by considering states with large spin J, but then it has turned out that the coefficient of the expansion are different. And even worse, the structure of the expansion is different, so there's really no point in doing this exactly. So what can we do? Well, I think we should then try to really find what's the right answer for string theory and what's the right answer for gauge theory at finite values for lambda. So let's try to compute ADS at large lambda and compute CFT at small lambda and see how far we get. And already we noticed that the structures that appear are very similar. Like in both models, you seem to be able to get a beta ansatz, which Matthias will talk about, and well, the scattering, very many similarities. And we even get some agreement. we don't quite understand why it should really be there, but it's there, so that could be understood. And then finally, we might be able to interpolate to finite. Extrapolate to finite lambda and see how that works. And actually, what I want to say is that this three-loop mismatch, so the difference between string theory and gauge theory, turns out to be precisely given by this new term that we found, multiplied by just one factor. So for all solutions we investigated, this relation holds. And therefore, we might think, okay, by including these corrections here, we might go from string theory to gauge theory if you put all orders in 1 over square root of lambda.
Another kind of
dimension? Yeah.
So the agreement, the coefficients of the field agreement is
miraculous.
You might probably say so. I'm only saying that this might be true. Actually, you can say because of the structural similarity, you have sort of local interactions for both theories. And you have symmetries, so you probably get the same answer at the first few orders. And
asymmetric theories, you don't get the same answer, even at lower order.
Yeah. Oh, no?
But there, the structure of the expansion is also different, right? Okay.
There's still another mystery that, from this point of view, if you put it this way, then you could really ask for why the original Yemen situation seems to work out. Also, we don't know.
I see no reason why it works out, but.
Well, come on.
It still works out.
It's nice to assume that the Yemen scaling holds in the gauge theory, and then. As you know better than anybody else, then somehow this root comes out from gauge.
Yes.
Well, for higher loop calculations, you're always using single trace operators.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you're.
We only use single trace operators because we're in the large end limit. Okay. So now I want to consider classical strings to start understanding how to get a handle on large lambda. And I'll start with classical spinning string solutions, just to give you an idea of what I will be talking about. Then consider the coset space sigma model in more generality and discuss its integrability. There's a Lax connection which relates to integrability in a monodromy matrix. And making use of that, we can derive finally a spectral curve and investigate its analytic properties. Also find out about the moduli of the string of all string solutions. This then goes by the name of finite cut or finite gap solutions. And finally, I just want to present shortly a set of integral equations. So spinning string solutions. There are many spinning string solutions that have been investigated. These are just large string configuration on a curved space, similar to the ones in flat space, but here we of course have a curved space. So there might be folded strings which spin, there are circular strings which spin, pulsating strings, you can also classify them like this. You can have higher modes, so multiply folded strings, and strings in plane wave you might consider as very short strings in this picture, but the good thing about them is that you understand how quantum corrections go, so they are a bit fuzzy if you want. So let's just review a very simple spinning string solution and restrict the space of ADS5 versus 5 to R cross S2, just to simplify things. So and use this new effective coupling, so we rescale by square root of lambda and makes it a bit simpler.
And
S2 is an S, and R is just the time of ADS. So you embed your string worksheet into R cross S2 in this way. The time just goes linearly with the worksheet time, and so it's spinning in one direction on the sphere, and it has some profile in the other direction. So you have a folded string which spins on the sphere. Plug this solution into the equations of motion into the equations of motion, and you find this solution for the profile. It's just some Jacobi amplitude function, and there's some modulus eta, and eta also relates how the spin to the energy. And there's, of course, a integration constant here.
Eta
is continuous, right. I think it's called Euler, Jacobi amplitude. It's some elliptic function.
Can you extend it sometimes? functions in the chain network?
No, not here, I think. You can. This relation of the spin and the eta and so on, this will turn out to be, well, let's see. So that's not all you have to do. Of course, I just assumed an infinite worksheet and just solve these equations. But you have to also consider, well, these are closed strings, so you have to consider periodicity. So you can either fold the string back into itself or take a circular string. If you impose that, you find that actually the spin and the energy are both given in terms of this modulus by these k and, by the k function here. Okay. It's just a modulus. So you have a family of solutions parameterized by eta, and of course this theta parameter from here. Oh, sigma naught. This is this goes. This is just a phase. Right. So the energy is given through eta. The spin is given through eta, and well, then you could express the energy through the spin, but in general, what happens is all the spins and all the spins on S5 and ADS5 and also the energy are given as some functions of several moduli. And these functions turn out to be either algebraic, elliptic, or hyperelliptic functions of the moduli. You might wonder, why do you get elliptic functions and what's the meaning of these moduli? And that's what I'll try to explain now. So so this was just one specific solution, and well, in general, you get elliptic and hyperelliptic functions. So it will certainly be too difficult to solve the equations of motion in general. And in flat space, that's actually what you did: you solved the equations of motion and then quantized that. But of course, this is not possible here. You might do something else. You might expand your string theory around plane waves. ADS5 plus S5 has a plane wave limit, and you might expand it around that. That turns out to be very difficult. You get certainly some good answers, but in the end it will only be an expansion. But it leads to, you can test your results for plane waves.
Yeah. I'm confused about which equations of motion you're solving. For example, is the Ramon-Ramon background important?
This is a Green-Schwarz formalism.
Okay, so you are taking that into account.
Yes. Okay. I'll just write down the sigma on the next slide, I think. Next. Now, what should you do? I think you shouldn't try to find the exact energy spectrum, because that's not feasible. But instead, you can try to at least classify the solutions, understand how they are organized in terms of the moduli. What's the structure? What's the generic structure of the spectrum? Like, you know, for classical strings, you know things are given by mode numbers and amplitudes. Can you do the same here? And then maybe there's a way to quantize that, of course, only heuristically. But so how can we go ahead?
You quantize it, you probably want to take into account fermionic
degrees of freedom. Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah. So first of all, I'd like to extract all the conserved charges. This is done by the Lux-Perl monodromy. And then investigate the analyticity properties. So I'll explain that. And from these analyticity properties, I can reconstruct a corresponding spectral curve, which turns out to be, in some restricted sense, an algebraic curve. And then maybe there's a way of discretizing this curve explicitly, which then would be some kind of beta ansatz, but I can't really go into that. So let's consider strings on ADS5 plus S5. I consider a cylinder as the worksheet. And this is embedded into ADS cross S cross fermions. And actually, this space is most conveniently viewed as a coset space of this supergroup by these two denominator bosonic groups, which is essentially just SO5 and SO4,1. And now we decompose the algebra of this supergroup to the denominator algebra to understand what's going on. So so any element of the algebra splits into four pieces here. H is part of this algebra. P is the remaining bosonic degrees of freedom, and Q1 and Q2 are fermions. And what's interesting about this split is that the algebra respects a Z4 grading with these gradings. And this is analogous to, say, if you want to break UN to SON or SPN, you can do transpose, and transpose gives you a Z2 symmetry. But here you have super matrices, you have a super transpose, and this is Z4 operation. Anyway, so this decomposition will be important to write the sigma model, or the string theory. So this sigma model is given by a field of the supergroup. It's just an 8x8 supermatrix, and from that you can construct the standard flat connection by this expression and decompose it. So this is the flattened connection, and this is how you decompose it. And now you're interested in a coset model, so you mod out by the denominator group, which is given by field H. And so this H will turn out to be a gauge field. P will be the bosonic degrees of freedom, and Q1 and Q2 are the fermions, or the fermionic currents. And the action is then given only through P, Q1, and Q2. And here there's a Lagrange multiplier, which takes care of, well, the PS of the PSU. So it removes a super trace. And, well, so now you can construct the Noether current for this model. Noether current is given by this expression, and it obeys the conservation condition for the Noether current, which is equivalent to the equation of motion. And furthermore, there are the Virasoro constraints, which come from variation by the worksheet metric, which is just essentially contained in here. So this action contains all these three equations. These three equations are the classical equations of motion, and I will consider just solutions to these three equations. That's all.
Does the formalism not come with Kappa symmetry?
Kappa symmetry is a bit obscure here, but it's there.
So you probably have to impose constraint on that formula?
No. So this system has a bosonic metric, worksheet metric, in here, but it doesn't have a fermionic metric. So Kappa symmetry is just there. There's no constraint associated with it. Okay, so now it was observed that this, found that this model is integrable, which means that there exists a so-called Lux pair or Lux connection, which is a family of connections given by this expression. So you have a family parameterized by this so-called spectral parameter, I call it Z, and it's given through the components of the current, H, P, Q1, and Q2. And the remarkable thing about this is it's a flat connection. So there's not only the flat connection J from the last transparency, but also this family of flat connections. And the flatness here is equivalent to the flatness of the other current and the conservation of K. So most of the equations of motion are just encoded into this structure. This connection is analytic for the complex plane. It has poles at zero and at infinity, and the point Z equals 1 is related to global symmetry. So if you expand around 1, you see first of all this flat current and then the Noether current here. And let me also note there's an alternative way of writing it where you use a spectral parameter X, which relates to Z by a double covering. So I'll interchange between the two, and there's a change of points. So X and Z are somehow equivalent. Okay. Now, of course, you now have this flat connection, and it's a neat way of expressing the equations of motion. But we can actually do much more with it, because we can extract you can extract physical data from the string using this thing. Physical data means something that does not depend on worksheet diffeomorphisms, something that is invariant under Kappa symmetry and under gauge transformations. So a good thing to look at is non-local information on the worksheet. And using the flat connection, you can do that. You can construct the Wilson loop, which winds once around the string, an open Wilson loop. This is called the monodromy, and it certainly is invariant under deformations of the path because it's a flat connection. And moreover, well, it's not quite independent of the starting point because it's an open Wilson loop. But when you're only interested in the eigenvalues, they are invariant under deformations of the path. So these eigenvalues are. This here takes you back to the original tangent space. So you wind it once around, but then it's a coset space sigma model, so the tangent space at x at sigma and sigma plus 2 pi need not be the same, so this just takes you back.
Okay. A is valued in the complement to the output. So this is like a compensating.
Yes, this is a compensating. And you can check that the eigenvalues are actually only invariant if you do this here, because otherwise you have some long Wilson movement. Okay, so let me just say that now if you do this, you have done a transformation on a solution. So you start with the solution, and if you do all this, you end up with a set of so-called quasi-momenta, which are these exponentials here. So You can view either the eigenvalues or the logarithms. The logarithms are called quasi-momenta. So these quasi-momenta are now conserved in gauge-invariant quantities. It's very good that you at no point need to fix any conformal or Kappa symmetry or gauge fixing. Just makes it very, very convenient to deal with. They are analytic functions of Z, and therefore much physical information is just contained in the peak in these quasi-momenta because they depend on the spectral parameters. So you get an infinite tower of physical information just from the quasi-momenta. That's very convenient. I don't know.
You get any more information if you wind around twice?
You can wind around twice, but if you take a trace, I mean, these eight eigenvalues are essentially equivalent to wind around several times and taking traces. Yeah. So if you wind around twice, I guess you just square this, right? Probably unitary or something.
First of all, it's a supermatrix, right?
It's a supermatrix, yes. There are problems, and these are actually. It's not Hermitian, it's unitary. I think it's unitary with respect to Z, so the inverse, when you take Z, the conjugate of Z should be. Adjoint.
This is bizarre, right?
No. This is contained.
A has those Q1s and Q2s.
This is one part. This is the other part. So this is 4x4. This is 4x4. And
they're both in bosonic blocks, aren't they?
Yeah, but the eigenvalues of the supermatrix are still bosonic. There are problems, and I'll come to that. These are actually interesting. Okay, let me just go on. Okay, I think the point is really you shift Z by a little bit and it's okay. You shift Z by a little bit and it will be okay. I mean, the problem would be at coincident eigenvalues, right? If they are all distinct, you can diagonalize it.
Right.
So you shift Z a bit. Sure, this happens, but this happens at isolated points, and these points are interesting. I'll come to that. So what I want to say is that you have much physical information, and maybe even all these quasi-momenta contain the action variable, the complete set of action variables in the Hamilton-Jacobi formalism. Of course, I don't know, but this seems reasonable. And right, your point. If you want to diagonalize omega, that introduces several singular points. These are the points you were speaking about. So, and these depend on the solution, they are interesting. Well, because this is no proof. This is just the religion, belief.
Well, if you can construct the
contours
of the
map,
then...
Oh, I can't, because I restrict to conserved quantities, and so I get only half of the phase space, and I'm never going to be able to go back, plus gauge choices, plus Kappa symmetry, plus the film office.
You can if you trace the eigenspaces at all. So this curve comes with the street recovery. Each eigenvalue comes with an eigenspace. So if you track the eigenspace, you can trace the symmetry.
But that also depends on the point where you are.
At each point, you have an eigenspace. Therefore, you have
if you know it for all points.
These are the angle variables.
Yeah.
So from this view, you can reconstruct the
symmetry. Okay, but I want to consider only the eigenvalues here. Now I want to extract physical information such as, say, the global charges. So if you expand the Lux connection at the point 1, you get the Noether current and therefore also the Noether charges if you integrate them up. Actually, so the monodromy gives you just this matrix of charges if you expand it. This translates to the quasi-momenta in this way. So the quasi-momenta at this point give you the energy, the two spins on ADS5 and the three spins on S5 in the first expansion coefficient. Now, there's also the conjugation symmetry I mentioned before. So when you take, this is related to taking supertransposes. Supertransposes work a bit different. So if you take two supertransposes, you don't quite get the original matrix, but you invert all the fermions. So you need to do it four times to get the original thing back. And now this translates to some conjugation of the connection. So you take the supertranspose of the connection and conjugate it by some matrix. And this gives you back this particular combination. This then translates to some symmetry of the monodromy matrix or of the Lux connection. So if you rotate the spectral parameter plane by 90 degrees, you get back the original connection or the original monodromy, but you here invert it and take the supertranspose and conjugate it. So this gives you some transformation property for the quasi-momenta. I'm not going to into detail. But if you rotate it by 90 degrees, you get the negative back and maybe some shift. So if you do this twice, actually, you see the quasi-momenta are not affected. That's to be expected because they are bosonic quantities, and bosonic quantities don't change under applying this twice. So therefore, it's OK to use X because, well, X and Z are relatively double covering, and you're interested. You only need to consider X. Now let's consider analyticity of the monodromy matrix. Certainly, the connection is analytic, so therefore the monodromy should be analytic. It's just a Wilson loop, except at those points where the connection is not analytic, at zero and infinity. So let's consider one of these points. Close to that point, the connection is very large because it goes like 1 over Z squared. And this allows us to diagonalize it, disregarding these non-local effects from the derivative. So we just diagonalize this matrix or the singular part of this matrix, and this derivative gives you sub-leading pieces. So we can diagonalize the leading part, and we find that this singularity at zero and infinity gives us potentially eight different eigenvalues, but due to several properties, there are only two independent ones. And here is actually where the Virasoro constraints play some role. also the tracelessness of P and this conjugation symmetry. But this is a special form related to ADS5 process 5 and probably doesn't appear in other signal models.
It happens only at the pole?
This happens at the pole, yes. And therefore, I mean, at this pole, you then can expand this in local conserved charges. Anyway, so you find that these quasi-momenta have a pole at zero, so a square pole at zero. Also at infinity, they have a square. And, well, this is only one thing, but as we diagonalize this matrix, we get new singularities which are related to those points where you can't actually diagonalize. So the diagonalization introduces new singularities in the complex plane in these quasi momenta. But let me discuss that. These are related to eigenvalue crossing. Generically, you have two eigenvalues which would cross at some point. So let's just consider a 2x2 bosonic matrix. These are the eigenvalues, and these are all to be understood as a function of z, some regular function of z. And at the point where the eigenvalues degenerate, of course, the square root must be zero. And generically, therefore, you get a square root singularity at those critical points. So you get this expansion at a set of points for every solution. And because it's a square root, a full turnaround ZA actually, well, it interchanges the two eigenvalues you're dealing with. So you do two turns, you have the original back. And this causes some trouble with the labeling of the eigenvalues, but that's our problem because we only look at the set of eigenvalues. Well, this labeling problem is resolved by introducing branch cuts into the complex plane. So when you cross a branch cut, you change the labeling. And of course, these branch cuts start at a square root and they must also end at some other square root. So this is what happens for bosonic branch points. Now, you can have also eigenvalue crossing for eigenvalues related to two different parts of the supermatrix. So we can do the same thing again. Consider a 2x2 supermatrix with generic functions of the spectral parameter. Diagonalize it, we get these two eigenvalues. And here we see that at the point where they are degenerate, A is equal D. So A is equal D, and therefore we get a pole here. So this is the difference between bosonic and fermionic singularities. And one thing one might keep in mind is that the residue B times C is a product of two odd quantities, and therefore it's nilpotent, so it's a bit weird type of singularity. But if we don't think about it too much, we can just treat it as a regular singularity. Okay, this is the... I just want to write down what the expansion is. So this is the... what's it called? Just the constant part. Drop the singular part. Principal value.
The space-time picture.
Okay, yeah. But let me. Oh, there, you see some space-time in here. Okay. Well, so let me plot all these eight quasi-momenta on the complex plane, and this is the picture I would get. So I would get a set of branch points connected by a branch cut, and I would get some of these fermionic singularities. Then there are singularities at x equals plus minus 1, well, z equals 0, infinity, or x equals plus minus 1. We get certain asymptotics at 0 and infinity, and we get a certain symmetry, x going to 1 over x, related to this conjugation property.
So these are type of singularities that appear when two eigenvalues coincide.
Yes, they can be, but that generically doesn't appear. So it's some singular values on the moduli space where this.
I mean, you can have Jordan blocks up to 4x4.
Oh, probably 8x8, no? I don't know. Yeah.
this can be regarded as some limit on those, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a generic case, so it's maybe like in string theory, you consider cubic vertices and quartic vertices are there, but there are some boundary.
I'm not sure you have that, but the family of matrices is diagonalizable, but at some point, degenerating that is some Gordon form, I don't think. That's the question.
Well, let's say this has not been considered.
It's depending on one complex parameter. So at least for a generic hat in the space of all matrices, it would only hit the 2x2 block.
Sure, that's what he said, but it's still for some solutions.
Well, let's consider a generic solution depending on certain parameters. And then, of course, there are points where these things coincide, but I will not consider those.
What would change in this picture if you did not impose them?
Well, I didn't even explain the picture, so maybe I first explain it. At least I was supposed to explain what's the physics of that, what's the space-time picture of that. So let me come to that first. So let's consider a very simple string solution where in the simplest string solution you have only these poles. You don't have any of these cuts or fermionic poles. So then you add some, say, bosonic cut somewhere. So so this you would call some bosonic excitation of the ground state. And the length of this this cut would correspond to the amplitude of this excitation. So
the longer the
cut is, the more excitations you put. Like in a string in flat space, you can excite an oscillator one time, or even excite it many times. So for bosonic excitations, the length of this cut gives you, roughly speaking, the excitation number. Then you have fermionic singularities. These are given just by poles, so there is nothing, no extension you can put. So, and that's that's a realization of the Pauli principle for fermions, and Bose condensates for bosons.
Are you making those statements by computing these conserved charges? That's what you mean by excitation
and
the amount of energy.
Well, maybe I don't know how to answer that. I don't do anything explicitly. I just look at that and see, with the example of some solution, what happens.
Oh, I see.
And well, just try to.
How did you arrive at the picture that the length of the cut corresponds to the number of excitations?
Well, I gave this heuristic explanation. This could be Bose condensates, and the other thing, fermions don't do that. And of course, we have some solutions where you can.
You mean string excitations, like the length of the cut is proportional to the string
of it? Essentially, the length of the cut will. Okay, consider a very simple solution. So this solution probably has just one cut somewhere. And you can see how long the cut is, and the longer it is, the longer the string will actually extend in space. Okay?
Some feature of action variables are expressed in terms of the modulus of the spectral curve. Action variables are those charges which generate periodic trajectories.
Yes.
So perhaps the length of the cut would be equal to some action variable.
Yes.
And then you would argue that in the semi-classical picture it would be integer or half.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's not really the length of the cut, but something that measures the length of the cut, and I'll come to that. So so this is one part. Furthermore, you can see a stringy spectrum of physical excitations. And by that, I mean these excitations, these cuts, or these poles, which relate to two of the sheets, they tend to like to go from one of these four sheets to one of these four sheets. That's because the poles here have a different residue from the poles here. And therefore, you can count how many different ways of connecting two sheets you have. And when you connect two sheets of the same type, you get a bosonic cut. And when you connect two sheets of a different type, you get something fermionic. And you just count that, you find 4 + 4 bosonic ways of connecting two sheets and 8 fermionic ones. So this gives you 8 + 8, which is what you expect from a n-dimensional superstring. So I think this is the best I can tell about a space-time picture here.
And if you decompose the Virasoro constraint, it's
the same thing? The Virasoro constraint in this construction has something to do with these poles, and probably if you don't impose it, the residues of these poles will not be the same here and the same here, but there will be more blocks and probably more types of excitations, and it will all be a bit wild then.
Yeah, I asked for some clarification. So I thought that all the equation, relevant equation, including the Virasoro constraint, were included in the flatness condition.
Not the Virasoro constraint.
Not the
Virasoro.
So we have to import that.
I don't really. Yeah.
The color coding green on this
picture. The what?
You have green, blue.
Oh. Oh, you can't even see that. Good. So red here is fermionics. Fermionic excitation. These are bosonic excitations of one type, so you have four sheets of one type and four sheets of another type. So these connect, say, excitations on S5, these would be excitations on ADS5, and these would be fermionic excitations, and these are the two poles that are there always. Oh, that's okay.
So does that mean this is actually
a
super
concept? Yeah, an even one, right? Oh, what would it be? I don't have a clear understanding.
So the p hat, I should not have to essentially an analytic function. It's an analytic function as well. It's a set of analytic functions. Because you can add to it an even notion
of
object.
Yeah, probably.
So it's something like four analytic functions.
Four?
Because it's only the
theta. Theta?
Not a supermatrix, right?
Oh, yeah.
Diagonalizing a supermatrix.
Oh, okay.
So a supermatrix has odd nilpotent sum. So I would think that if I diagonalize a supermatrix, and generally the eigenvalues are
yes.
even, but that doesn't mean that they're actually complex numbers.
Okay. Well, you don't really have to consider the fermions if you don't want to. These will give you these poles, but for classical solutions, fermions are a bit odd to consider anyway. And I don't really understand it, but you can forget about them, and then it's just a bosonic thing. But I think it's good to understand how they would look like in a going towards quantum theory, what happens, and that you can do. Essentially, don't think about nilpotent stuff. Easiest thing. Okay, so maybe just to wrap up, what I've done is starting with the solution which is defined on the cylinder, the world sheet cylinder, I've derived a spectral curve which somehow looks like this, and I think it gives you a good understanding of the physical picture even in space-time, because you see how the string excitations come about in this picture.
Do you have an algebraic description?
So now the question is, can the Riemann surface
this? Can I ask one question about? So you said that you can compute conservatively. So I asked
yes.
So can you actually compute, for example, energy of the
yes, the energy
given this algebra?
Well, the energy. Well, the energy you get from the quantum expanding around a certain point.
Yeah. So can you given this diagram, can I read out the energy?
Yes. So the charges of S5 and ADS5, where energy is one of them, would be obtainable at the point zero or at the point infinity. You just expand around it. The first coefficient gives you the eigenvalues of the.
We have to find holomorphic function with this singular behavior.
Yeah.
And then expand it near equal to zero to extract the energy.
Yes. But what's good about it is you say, okay, you want a string with a certain type of excitation, excitation number for bosonic modes, and then you say, okay, you have a one-cut solution, you impose certain constraints, it's not the most general algebraic curve that you have, and then you can expand it around zero and get the energy of this solution. So I think you really work in terms of physical quantities all the time here. So let's see about the algebraic structure of the curve. So can we embed this in C2 as an algebraic curve? Well, first of all, we certainly need finite genus. And for that, we need to assume that there are finitely many singularities. Of course, for generic solution, this might not be the case. But those solutions, maybe they can be considered as some limiting cases here anyway. I'll consider only finitely many. And then the eigenvalues of omega are analytic functions almost everywhere. As I said, OK, there are, of course, certain singularities, but these are square roots and pole singularities, and that's what you expect anyway.
Did you change from f to x? Or
yes. X is the same thing as z, essentially. Now, the monodromy, however, has these exponential singularities at x equals plus minus 1, these singularities that come from the connection, from the Lux connection itself. So there are exponential singularities, and they certainly don't come from an algebraic curve. What you could do is you can take the logarithms of the eigenvalues, but these then are, of course, defined only modulo 2 pi. So this is also not an algebraic curve. But if you take the derivative of the quasi-momenta, this moduli 2 pi goes away, and the p prime is actually a unique function, because there's only square root and pole type singularities, and that's why it should be an algebraic curve. Well, not a very mathematical statement, but anyway, you can obtain this algebraic curve. Well, now we have for each classical string solution, which is reasonably nice, we get an algebraic curve. And this algebraic curve, you can also get, you get it as a quotient of two functions because it's a supersymmetric matrix. And this is somehow related to the determinant of the monodromy. So you get this algebraic curve given by a quotient of two polynomials of degree 4. And what you see here is that, you have an algebraic curve, so these things have finite genus. For example, the genus 0 solutions or the genus 1 solutions give rise to algebraic and elliptic functions, and that's what we saw for the simplest spinning string solutions. So this is an explanation why spinning string solutions have this structure, yes.
And turning it around from p prime of x, is there a constructive procedure to get g?
In principle, yes, but you need to put in more information again, because there are gauge degrees of freedom that you need to fix, kappa symmetry, gauge symmetry, diffeomorphisms, and you also lose all the angle variables because everything is a conserved quantity here. So what really happens is that really a class of solutions here goes into one algebraic curve or one spectral curve. Yes. Right. So yeah, that's.
You haven't told us the line bundle, but there should be a while. It's the eigenbundle which comes with each eigenvalue. Each eigenvalue has corresponding eigenspace, and then defines the line bundle over this curve.
That sounds good. Okay.
So I was restricting to action variables here, and you need to supplement it for all solutions, but.
It's okay. If you have two solutions with the same harmonic excited but with different phases for the harmonics,
yes.
Are they the same in this description?
They are the same in this description.
They actually have all the same conserved quantities?
They have all the same conserved quantities. They therefore also have the same energy, and that's what we are after. So that's why I only consider
So if you fix the gauge and you fix these angle variables, then you can construct a G of balancing.
Yes, I guess. There are some theta functions you have to use. And this, I think this is discussed also in other types of solutions.
Is this all something standard from the theory of inverse scattering? I mean, is it,
I think it's, yeah.
Is it work whenever you will ask there? Is it?
I think it's inverse scattering methods.
KDD equation, for example, you would get from your curve, you get a tau function, and then you can always start from the curve with a line line.
Okay.
Get a tau function, which is the determinant of the V bar operator on that curve, coupled to that line line. Then you go back. Then there's a simple formula for the original solution of the KDD equation.
Okay. Yeah.
If you take the theta functions on that Jacobian, you could actually construct something like that.
Right. But how explicit can you be with that?
Well, I don't know anything about this, but I mean, in the KDD case, you can produce a solution, solid on solutions of the KDD.
But is there one case of this where the law?
But then perhaps you don't have to go back, you can quantize in terms of this variable.
What
would you do? Yes. It's this solution. So you can think of this as a action variable and one of this is an angle variable.
So do we need angle variables for a quantization?
I think so. You need a phase space structure. I need to quantize phase space. Phase space is a space of solutions.
Yeah, but I always thought that in some sense by using the oscillator constructions, you put all the phases on top of each other, and there's only one global phase, the U1 phase. Which I don't know. So.
Why did you write the equation? So why can't I just multiply my building?
Yeah, I think this is just related to fermions and Grassmann odd stuff and nilpotent stuff. And, this is the way you write. You write super.
What's the equation?
Well, there are two equations, right? There's one which equals zero, one which equals infinity. And this gives you the p tilde and p hat.
So that's two equations.
You see, here are four. Four tildes, and tildes would probably be zero, while the hats would be infinity. It's
There are two algebraic curves, f hat equals zero, and f tilde equals zero.
Yes, but I'm not sure if you can disentangle them easily.
Do you have simple examples of this equation?
Yes, I mean, several examples have been worked out, but not in the way that we really relate the classical solution to this picture, but usually you just start in this picture and do everything in this picture.
I think nobody worked out the simplest generic solution, right? And the simplest solution right. That kind of contained all the features nobody worked out.
Yeah.
It should be pretty difficult.
For example, you can parameterize the genus one surface by a few parameters. Maybe.
Sure. Yes.
So a string that smooths the one that corresponds to the plane waves. What is it in this description?
The plane wave, okay. The vacuum of the plane wave is actually the vacuum of this thing, so you have only these two poles and nothing else.
No,
No, the vacuum is just these two poles which are just there.
Oh, it's a vacuum.
Now you want to add excitations in the BMN way, and for that you can add either these fermions here, or you can add bosons and just one. I mean, if you take a cut and take the small cut limit, it will turn into a pole. So bosons and fermions are in that sense on an equal footing. And then you can add many, many bosons at the same place, and the cut grows and grows and grows, and this doesn't work for fermions.
What does genus correspond to?
Pardon?
What does genus of the curve correspond to?
Complexity. I think there was someone said that it's somehow the number of intersections the string takes. I'm not sure.
Isn't the number of oscillators very exciting?
number of different types of, in this picture, yes. In this picture, it's the number of different string oscillators you.
You can get something that's similar to cuts by just using excitations with the same, with confluent mode numbers, which you can do for bosons.
Yeah. So the genus up to one or two is the number of string oscillators that you excite many times each.
From your interpretation, it was the number of cuts which
were. Well, the genus is the number of cuts.
Up to.
Each cut is gotten by taking a large number of single models.
Yeah, that's the picture, and that's also what I have in mind when I say quantization. So instead of considering these smooth cuts, you could say these cuts arise as a condensate of several of these poles. And then you get a quantum description because also the mode number, the excitation number of such a cut is now quantized.
So you need to imagine quantized version of this would be just poles.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the funny way is there's two ways to discretize these cuts. I mean, like just sort of one of our check, like choke. And you can sort of, when you make J finite, then it discretizes, but you can also move away from lambda if it's very large.
You know what happens in the picture then? When you turn on the Wolfshi coupling, you look, do these things get fast?
I think we might discuss this then in Maria's talk. Good idea. Just two more things before I stop. Fortunately, I can't go to gauge theory. The moduli of these curves, of the spectral curve, you can investigate a generic curve and see how many degrees of continuous degrees of freedom you have. These would be the stringing moduli. So let's look at that. So you start with the fact that the eigenvalues of the monodromy matrix must be single-valued. So e to the ip is single-valued. However, you're looking at p prime, and so if e to the ip is single-valued, p is single-valued modulo 2 pi, and therefore all closed cycles of dp must be multiples of 2 pi. So all closed cycles of this dp on the spectral curve must be multiples of 2 pi, and they give you a mode number of certain configuration. So actually now you can arrange the cuts in different ways, and you can arrange them in such a way that all the A cycles around the cuts, like this here, all those A cycles are zero. Then the B cycle, which is essentially a cycle which goes through the cut, maybe to some special point or some other cut, this gives you essentially the mode number of this cut. It must be a multiple of 2 pi and gives you therefore an integer. And this integer you can interpret as the mode number of this stack, this tower of excitations, if you want. And then you can measure the length of the cut using this integral. Essentially, it's the integral of p dx with some normalization factor. And this you then call the amplitude for this cut.
I'm sorry, I guess I'm confused. So this is still classical theory.
This is the classical theory.
So mode number refers to.
Well, mode number refers to the fact you have a closed string. So still on this closed string, you can expand it in terms of modes. This is a Fourier mode of the string. And well, this turns out to be a good thing to consider. Fourier mode. I'm not sure. Do you get this for the classical solution already? I'm not sure.
You are assuming string is glass, right?
Yes.
For both of ADS scale?
Yeah, I mean, it's on the order of the curvature.
Right, so you, can you still make the flat space?
What is it, high low number?
I'm not sure. Did no one did really consider this? I'm not sure.
I mean, you
can
take lambda large and say very small, right?
I'm not sure. So, I will discuss later.
The first condition, is that the choice, or are there other solutions for the first condition lesson?
Oh, this one? This is just you can arrange the cuts by an SL 2Z or SP 2 genus transformation, and so this is just a choice which allows you then to measure also the length of this cut in this way. So the length of the cut is roughly given by the integral, the A cycle of PDX, or what's that, XDP if you want. And now, therefore, I'd say, I mean, I emphasized this before, that the solution is now classified by how these cuts connect the eight sheets of the curve. you understand what the mode numbers are and what the amplitudes are. And it turns out that there is precisely one amplitude for each bosonic, for each cut of the solution. So these are the amplitudes are the continuous moduli of spring solutions.
Are you saying that if you know the sheet structure,
yes,
all of them are the amplitudes, that becomes a function?
Yes.
And
maybe up to the coupling constant. I'm not so sure now how it really works, but
some parameters that are being disposed of x equal to 1 and 0, right?
But these are all determined through. I mean, physically speaking, you would just say, okay, I want a string solution with this excitation so excited so and so many times and so on and so forth. And
yeah, it looks like the right number of parameters.
So yeah. There, yes, I'd say so. You make by saying you have so and so many cuts, you make an ansatz for the algebraic curve. You write down some algebraic equation, and then you fix one by one the parameters by actually setting these cycles to zero and these cycles to n. You just have the right number of equations. To get everything you want.
So A refers to both cut and pole?
Yes, in principle you can do this for a pole. It's just one point and then A cycle is zero and this goes through this pole. This is a bit strange thing, but not too bad. Okay, so one final one. So this is a different way of representing the algebraic curve or the spectral curve, and this makes the comparison to gauge theory and to beta ansatz more easy. But so you can, instead of taking P as some solution to an algebraic equation, you can also parameterize it in terms of its cuts and singularities. So you have a analytic function, so you need to know where are the cuts and the singularities. And here, so you you give the cuts in terms of a discontinuity function across the cut, and you know the residues, and then these integrality conditions turn into integral equations for these density functions. So these equations would somehow look like that. Here you get the mode number, and here you get some singular integral equations for these things. And what's sort of interesting is that here you get the Cartan matrix for the symmetry group, PSU or SU224, And there are some other potentials which are related to the theory. Sigma model really is works. And okay, well, I'm sorry, I can't really go on with the gauge theory, so let's see if I have some conclusions. So my conclusions for this part would be we've tried to compare ADS-CFT, the spectra in ADS-CFT, and seen that there is actually no exact perturbative comparison possible. It's a bit disappointing, but then again, maybe using integrability, we can compare the full finite lambda values exactly at some day. For 2B strings, I've discussed the classical spectral curve for each solution and investigated its feature. And then, in Matthias' talk, we will make use of integrability for gauge theory. we should try to quantize this string spectral curve in the way I discussed. And finally, maybe there's a way of finding exact beta answers for ADS-CFT, which somehow goes along the way, lines of this discretized spectral curve, or maybe even something else. So thank you.
Any more questions?
So the integrable systems are often related to free turbulence.
Yes. Well, in some sense, you could say that in this picture, these things are fermions, and this would be a collection of fermions because, you can excite bosonic oscillators one time or many times, but here what happens is they don't go precisely on the same spot. So there's one, you start with one excitation, you put the next excitation, it doesn't just go right on top of that, but it spreads out, and this is in some sense also a fermionic way of thinking about it.
There might be a fermionic description, but it's an integrable system, so it's more than free. That's the exciting thing. It's interacting, but integrable.
Yeah, but often you translate, like, I'm thinking of KDB, you translate to free fermions on an algebraic curve.
Yeah, but quantum spin chains, typically there's only very few special point parameters for space there that become free fermions. Otherwise, they're really not free fermions. There's no way to transform the beta equations of such generic quantum spin chains into free equations.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank him.